Well, welcome to the Craft and Character Podcast. Steve Carter here, and in association with my good friends at CDF Capital and Food for the Hungry. Today, I'm excited because you know why this whole podcast exists. It's to talk about the art of and craft of communication. But as pastors and leaders and shepherds, we always want to be the kind of people where our character is leading the way. And every once in a while, I come across a book that I will read, I will devour, and I just know right from the jump that this is a book that the Craft and Character audience needs to be aware of, needs to go and get, needs to read. And today we are going to be talking with Wynn Collier. And he was a pastor for 25 plus years out in Charlottesville, Virginia at All Souls. Most recently is at Western Seminary. But he is the author of A Burning in My Bones, which is this amazing biography on the life of America's pastor, Eugene Peterson. So, Wynn, thank you for joining us on the Craft and Character Podcast.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Well, let's just start because what's awesome is you're an amazing, an accomplished writer. But you've been a pastor. Talk about your time at All Souls. You were the founding pastor, but give us a little bit about that and then your current move to Holland, Michigan, and what you're doing there.
Well, I've been a pastor for 25 years, as you mentioned, and we moved in 2008 from South Carolina to Charlottesville, Virginia to help found All Souls, which is a beautiful little band of Christians and sinners and pilgrims, and had every intention really of retiring from there, but in a strange, unexpected move, we were asked to come to Western Seminary in Michigan, in Holland, Michigan, and to help found the Eugene Peterson Center for Christian Imagination. So, you know, for decades, I've had, I guess what I would consider a dual vocation of writer and pastor, and Eugene and I had some like points of connection there because he named those two vocations as sort of pillars of his life, and so one informed the other. And so in this work at the seminary, it's a chance to encourage and blow some wind on the embers of the flame of pastoral integrity, which is Eugene's heart and mission, and at the same time work with writers and artists and creatives and curious Christians, and having the same kind of conversations that Eugene had and seeing how we could be a witness to this grand and beautiful story that God is writing and follow in the way that Eugene did.
That's amazing. You know, how did you first get introduced to Eugene's work, and where were you in the life of your like pastorate ministry?
Well, it was very early on. I had finished seminary, and we were in Denver, Colorado, where I was a bivocational pastor. I was at a very small church that had like three splits and was really struggling. I was really young, newly married, way in over my head. Had just come out of a very difficult church situation where I'd been at a church for 2 years as an associate pastor. And it had just been a really brutal experience with a brutal environment, frankly. And I was reeling from that. And I came to this church that was struggling. And I was filled with all these ideas. Now I was going to finally have my chance to put my mark on a church. In some ways, I was reacting to the previous bad experience, but also was filled with youthful zeal. And this church had really struggled. And I thought, boy, if we could just, and I think I even had a meeting with some of the leaders where I used the word visioneering, you know, if we could just visioneer our future. And I think there were some good intentions there, but there was also a lot of ignorance. And one day on a Sunday after church, one of the elders came up to me and handed me a copy of Eugene's Working the Angles and said, I think you might enjoy this. And later in retrospect, I understand he meant, I think you need this. And I went home and I was a couple, probably just paragraphs in, and my heart was pierced. I was prepared for something I didn't know that I was prepared for. I was prepared to have my world undone by a beautiful, wide vision of what it meant to be a pastor. And I just began to gobble them up. And then a couple of years later, my first book was being published by a publisher of Eugene's, and I got them to give me his address. And so I started writing him letters, and the relationship just kind of took off from there.
That's amazing. I love that. You know, every one of us in pastoral work has had one of those moments where someone gave us a book that we, at the beginning of it, as we started to read, didn't know how much our soul and our heart and our spirit needed it. And what a great, great elder to give you that book. Working the Angles is fantastic. You know, it's amazing to think that, you know, and you kind of describe this right from the beginning of the book, but how this biography came to be. And I'd love just to hear, you know, you start writing these letters, he endorses a book, but a friendship begins to the point where you, towards the end of his life, have this moment that almost that you feel like you want to write this, but not sure how to start this conversation. Lead us from that point of him kind of reading your first book up to how the world was gifted with you getting the permission to write A Burning in My Bones.
Yeah. You know, I do think it's important to back up and say there was some real disappointment along the way. Like many of us, I mean, Eugene became a deep source of hope for me. Not because of him necessarily, though it certainly was his way, but it was, he was a voice for something that I ached for. And so I began writing letters. I probably thought it was something unique to me, but he was writing letters with all kinds of people. I would learn later, as I literally was piling through thousands and thousands of letters. So we wrote letters. I did ask him to endorse one of my earlier books, and he said no. And he didn't, you know, he was kind and generous, but I mean, I learned this. I mean, he was asked to endorse hundreds of books. He couldn't possibly, you know, and that was disappointing to an extent. But then another time I wrote him a letter and asked if I did a pastoral retreat in Montana, could I spend an afternoon with him? And he wrote me back a kind letter, but just said, you know, no, I don't have space for that right now in my life. And I knew lots of other people that had been able to go and meet with him. And I remember just feeling really sad, not because he said no, but just because I thought, you know, I don't think I'm going to have that chance for that slow, lingering conversation. I remember when the documentary came out, yep, of Nav Press put out about Eugene's life. And I had had some conversations with Eugene before that. I'd met him in Juneau, Alaska, when he was there with his oldest son teaching at a really small Presbyterian church. It was a beautiful little weekend. I went there to be there for that little spiritual life conference, and I had breakfast with him in his hotel, and we'd connected a few times. But I remember when this documentary came out, and I was watching it one evening, and it ended, and I thought, I just felt sad. I thought, I don't think I'm ever going to see him again. But then a year or two later, I went to Montana for a pastoral retreat, and I did get together with Eugene while I was there. So, the earlier sadness was assuaged. And, as I was leaving, I just began to think about someone was going to write his story. And I started thinking about what I hoped that story would do, what it would be like, and what I hoped it wouldn't do. You know, biographies have a way of making it a person in their own image, pulling someone into fights and conversations they weren't really having on their own, right? And so I wrote him a letter, fully aware that Eugene, the last thing he was interested in was having a biography written about him. Right. And so he calls me back a couple of weeks later. We talk about it. And I asked him the question. I said, Eugene, when you think about this, does it give you energy or does it tire you out? And he said, oh, when? It just tires me out. And I was like, well, that's what I thought. And so I thought that'd be the end of the conversation. But for some reason, we kept talking. And about 10 minutes later, he said, "Wynn, I think I have energy now. I think you're supposed to do this." And so off we went on this 4-year journey of writing the story. And it was humbling, beautiful, terrifying, fulfilling, all of those things.
Well, you know, in 1.5 sittings, and half of it just because my flight ended and I had to get to the next flight, I was transfixed by this book. The writing, you are so gifted. We'd never met before, but you could tell just the pastoral heart you have. But the ways that you were letting Eugene's life, but there were so many pieces that I didn't know. I'm a sports guy, so I'm like, you know, the first quarter of the book, and I find out, you know, he called Phil Jackson, the former coach of the Bulls and Lakers and Knicks, like his parents for his first church plant, you know, and just all of this, these like random small worlds. Even I didn't know about Pat Robertson going. And so there's all of these weird pieces that you just put together in this book that really, really details. But I want to read one piece, because I found myself in the early parts, I didn't know that is the degree of his father as a butcher. And you wrote something early on that I just thought, man, this was something that it seemed to be so definitive of how Eugene lived and wrote from probably his experience at a butcher shop. But you say, Eugene remembered when talking about carving, he said, "Eddie insisted was an art requiring patience." This is referring to butchering, "attention and years of practice. Carving a quarter of beef into roasts and steaks was not a matter of imposing my knife fortified will on dumb matter," Eugene remembered, "but respectfully and reverently entering into the reality of the material." And I was like, oh my goodness, this guy was like not just great at exegeting culture or exegeting scripture. He was doing this from a butcher shop. I found myself just moment after moment, there were all of these surprises in the book. I imagine as you were diving into thousands of letters, as you were getting to see the backstory of how Eugene became the pastor, the father, the husband that he was, the friend. What were some other surprises from the book that you were like, I didn't know this story, or I didn't know this to be so essential in his life, or so, I don't know, transformational in his story. But really, really, when you now look back, go, I can see it. I can see how that experience was so pivotal for him.
Yeah. In some ways, it wasn't singular experiences. It was depth of texture. So, you know, for those of us who met Eugene either through his books or in person, you know, well into his ministry, after he had grace had been so deepened in his heart, it's in some ways interesting to encounter him, for instance, as a student writing letters back home, and talking about his experience as, you know, student body president, and his the way he would talk about leadership, and it sounded like what you would expect from a young, idealistic, zealous college student who's trying to make his mark. And so I think one of the things that I think a perception I had, probably without really recognizing it, was thinking in some ways that this was just this sort of contemplative way, this God-aware way, this slow and deeply human way, that's just who Eugene was. Right. And I needed to sort of learn that. But realizing that some of that was who he was, but some of it was also a grace that had to be fostered in his life, and that he was ambitious and he was zealous. And, you know, he would talk a lot in his later books about the evils of as pastors having these idealistic visions of the church. And I think it's because when he was an early pastor, he had an idealistic vision of the church.
Yeah.
And it crushed him. And he saw how it crushed other people. And so in many ways for me, it was recognizing, man, he was just a normal teenager. He was a normal college student. He was gifted in so many ways, yes, but he also, and in some ways the parallel with Pat Robertson was, you know, what an interesting story it would have been if he had followed Pat's invitation to join him in building this TV network, right? Yeah. And just recognizing, you know, Eugene believed that so much of our life is out of our control. We think we control it, but we really don't. That God, it's grace, and recognizing how God's grace and then his response to it for sure led him on a path that made him the Eugene that he was.
What do you think tamed that youthful idealism that he had for what the church could be or needed to be or what he thought it should be? What were those experiences and those challenges that he had in ministry that maybe helped move him? Because I think I was so similar to you when, like, with the times that if Eugene came up, I'm like, man, this guy's probably been a 5 on the Enneagram his whole life. Like, he's just someone who loved to research, or someone who loved maybe a 4 wing with just quiet. He could just feel content. But then all of a sudden you see who he was at and like at Seattle Pacific and just running for student body president, you know, running track, like almost becoming this personality, this leader, but also still at some points feeling like an outsider, as you write about. But I feel like there was some moments in his life, and like you said, not singular, but there were probably a few moments in his life where something happened that tamed that pursuit of it's got to be bigger, bigger, more to be healthy and grace and more integrous to who God was really wanting him to be as a shepherd and pastor.
Well, I think he just had a real tenderness toward people. He loved being the protector for his younger sister. I don't actually remember if this story was in the book or not. Right at this moment, we cut 130,000 words, so there was a lot that got cut. But there was the story where his sister had a really bad bike wreck, and he carried her home blocks away. And in talking to Karen, you know, even now, last couple of years, I mean, she always saw him as a protector, and he was always looking out for the person who was left out. He was the one that was going over to a neighborhood boy who was wheelchair bound and, you know, playing checkers with this boy. He was the one who, there was a girl who in high school was kind of an outsider, wasn't part of the in crowd, but she got a big crush on Eugene. Eugene wasn't really interested in her romantically at all, but he would always go out of his way to invite her to youth group events and sit with her at church because he just cared about people. And so I think as he got older and as he saw his own way of pastoring that ran the risk of manipulating people for our own ends, to grow a church, to make a church big, to try to use people for building the church as opposed to allowing the church to be a space where God's grace heals people. I think there was something about that really set him on edge, and he began to recognize that danger. And so he had the capacity to see his own shortcomings and then to want something different.
In the book, you know, you detail something that I had heard, you know, that he never wanted the church to be more than 500 people. I think you actually say that that was actually ascribed to him, but he often, I think, said 800 people. But it was about, can a pastor know the names of the people, know the stories of a people? Do you know how that even idea came about for him of, man, like he had this potential to grow something, but somehow he knew his own, had seen like capacity limitations. I mean, I think there's a lot of younger pastors who, you know, they with Instagram exploding, with marketing tools, with opportunities to get on conference stages or book deals, blah, 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 all that stuff. There's something I feel like that was so integrous to, like you just alluded to, not wanting people to be used for his thing, but to create the space. But it seemed like he got really practical about that. Can you talk about that?
Sure. One, just to clarify, because I do think it's really interesting, is so he actually did often use the number 500.
He did. Okay.
But that wasn't really like, you know, again, lots of times people hear Eugene and they think that he's being more like dogmatic than he even means. Like he just, that was a symbol, a metaphor. But what you're probably remembering is what was interesting about this. He pulled that number because he thought it was the size of his senior class at SBU. And when he was a senior class president, he wanted to know everybody's name. And so he memorized the name of every student before they arrived on campus his senior year, which is astounding to me. I don't think I could do that. But what I recognized later in looking through his class records is that his senior class was actually closer to 800. So the funny thing was, he said it was 500 because of that, but it actually was 800. But I think something about that, the fact that even as a senior in college, that there was something inside of him that knew he needed to know people's names if he was going to lead them. I don't know where that came from other than the butcher shop.
The butcher shop, yeah.
So growing up as a son of a butcher, one of the things he always recognized is how his dad treated the customers. And in many ways, it was more like a family or a church than a business. That his dad knew people's names when they came in. And that it was a meeting place for all kinds of people. So those who were, you know, buying New York strip and ribeyes, and then those who were buying the, you know, pig's feet and the bologna, right? And that they were all welcome there, and he knew all of their names, and he knew what they ordered and when they ordered it. And yet the one person who felt like they didn't really fit in the butcher shop was always the pastor. Because the pastor would come in with a certain air. He wasn't part of the butcher shop scene. It was the pastor that embarrassed his dad, because he would also get super spiritual and he would somehow talk his dad into giving away steaks, you know. And there was something that intuitively to Eugene said, there's something wrong here, that the most human experience is my dad, the butcher. And the most inhuman person in this room is the pastor, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. And I think he set out to be different.
And it's weird because there was all these almost dichotomies in Eugene's life. I mean, his mom is this, you know, pastoral presence speaking to, you know, truck drivers and loggers and just could preach the paint off the walls. You know, Eugene goes to try and meet with different voices that people had recommended. And the last person that he goes and he meets with is someone that nobody thinks anything good can come from, and the most unlikely suspect. And it just seems like all the people that you think in this story should have had the most influence, it wasn't. It was all these other periphery characters. I'm curious, when you think about today's pastor, and you know, you being at All Souls for 25 years, and what do you think is the thing that the pastorate ministry needs to learn most from the life and the example that your research, that your friendship with Eugene showed you, that you just go, man, if I give a silver bullet, I know this is a wild question, but more pastors had this, what would that be?
You know, in some ways it's hard to answer, because Eugene was super slow to want to say a general word to all pastors. You know, he wanted to say a word to the pastor that was in front of him. I do think there's something about not being afraid to actually be a pastor. Mm. it's a scary thing in some ways, because most of the ways we're conditioned and taught, and most of the ways our personality seem to move toward is toward things that can easily debilitate being an actual pastor, like wanting to build our reputation, wanting to judge ourselves by the size of our congregation or its supposed effectiveness. And Eugene would just insist over and over again that we don't actually control these things. We think we control them, but we don't. And we're at the mercy of the grace of God. And to be a pastor is to be whoever God has uniquely made you to be. And don't try to be Eugene. be Wynn, be Steve. And then be filled with eyes to see God and a heart that longs for God, and then move that direction, inviting other people along. I'm not sure that there's any further wisdom that moves much beyond that. There are things that can help that be more possible. There's things that can accompany that, but pointing our life to God and inviting others to it, that's the work.
That's beautiful. That is so beautiful. Eugene also, and you talk about this in detail in the book, but he faced challenges in ministry. How did he handle that, you know, as a pastor, as a man, and as a father? What did you learn about how Eugene handled the challenges that come from ministry?
You know, it's not very glorious for sure. He kind of endured. He describes that over 6-year season of the Badlands, where he would have left the church if God would have let him. He tried, you know, which is important to remember, I think, when we hear him later talking about stability, that he tried to leave, you know.
Yeah.
But he just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and he gave himself to some really physical human places that allowed his mind and heart to connect in ways that when he wasn't feeling the beauty of ministry. So he took back up woodworking, which was part of his family craft, and that's when he and Jan started their Monday Sabbaths and their long hikes, and he went back to running. He returned to running. So he found some friends, a spiritual director and another pastor who would just pray with him and point him toward God. And then he trusted that somehow in the strange economy of grace that God was doing something that he couldn't see. And he learned to trust that.
That's so good. I mean, right now, you know, as people are talking, and Barna has, you know, I think written recently, you know, 30% of pastors would quit if they could, you know. And I was thinking, man, like, what fresh word would Eugene have, you know? And in a lot of ways, I think I love hearing the humanity piece where he's like, I would have, and I wanted to, but just that endurance word, it's a lost art in so many ways. I another question I have too is, you know, even at the very beginning of the book, I love, you kind of have this little drawing of Montana and where he grew up. And I just love the little like map of it. I remember a number of years ago, I met John Tyson in a conference, and he was doing next gen ministry, I think, at a church in Orlando, and had like piercings, and he was just young and vibrant. And then I took a team. We went out to New York to be with him, with his crew out there, and he was dapper. And I just remember walking up to him and just asking him the simple question. I said, "Hey, I remember years ago, this was my first interaction with you. And now, you know, you're like suit, you're in New York. How did this come to be?" And I'll never forget. And it came to me again as I was reading your book. He said, "New York allows me to be the fullest expression of who God made me to be. And I feel comfortable in my own skin." And it really feels that way that Montana taught Eugene, but it really allowed him to be the fullest expression. Talk about the power of place and what that space and what the lands of and the lakes and just that environment, how that shaped him as a man and pastor and father and son.
Well, Eugene said you can never separate theology from geography.
Wow. And
so theology that is not situated in geography is abstract, and it's not very well suited for the incarnation. So when you're a young boy and you grow up in these majestic mountains and you spend Saturdays alone in the woods, immersed in this land that is dangerous and raw, immersed in stories of native cultures that are in the land all around you, that it awakens imagination and it gives you an experience of God's presence that gets into you, into your blood, into your thinking, and it's not something that's put there by books, right? Which is another grace. It's also good, but there's something that's very near and immediate. And I think there's something about the Western culture, the Montana way, that was he never was at ease in situations where he felt like conversation was getting too heady, where it was something that wasn't grounded in the real world, that it wasn't something, a kind of conversation you could have had in the butcher shop. In some ways, I think if it's language that doesn't work in the butcher shop, it's probably not language that's very well suited to transforming people's lives for most of us. And that even showed up later when he was translating the Message, because he wasn't that whole story. He didn't start by translating the Message for America. It was for Hartford County, Maryland. And smaller than that, it was for Christ Our King Presbyterian Church. And smaller than that, it was for this little Sunday school group that he led, where he was trying to figure out why the power and evocative imagery of Galatians was not igniting in their heart. And he said, okay, I'm going to write it in their language. And so he did. So, you know, everything was specific. It was for the people right in front of you. And I think that's something that's, you know, in our digital age where we can be removed from most everyone and just pop in and out, I think we're losing some of this, the specifics.
Man, that's so beautiful. I mean, because I think a lot of times people are like, well, the Message, how did that come to be? And they just don't know the story of, man, here's this heart of a pastor who wanted and struggled with the reality. Why isn't Galatians resonating? And so what's that resistance? And so using this ability to write, to try and help them see the imagery, the power, the beauty, the sacredness of this letter. It's just, again, just once again, showcases that pastoral heart. And I love how you said that, to the people that were right in front of him, to the right in front of him, not to the crowds, not to the, you know, someday I might be on this. It was to the people that he was faithful with that God had placed right in front of him. Part of this podcast is really, you know, again, on the craft of communication. You know, we often, and I feel like I've actually never heard Eugene preach a message. I've read a lot of his books. How was he as a preacher in your research? What did you find in his preaching that what was the style of the way in which that he preached?
You know, honestly, by most criteria that we think of these days, he was not a very good preacher. He didn't mesmerize people. He wasn't a wonderful communicator. You had to really listen because he had such a raspy voice. Much of the time he read his sermons, there was seasons where he would move away from that and not read his sermons and do them extemporaneously without notes or minor notes. And after a short season of that, one time, one Sunday afternoon, Jan encouraged him that maybe he should return to the manuscripts. But I think in some ways, it's a powerful thing because it, in another sense, he was deeply moving as a preacher. And maybe this gets to the heart of your work here with this podcast. I don't know for sure, but I'll let you be the judge. But there was something that he carried within his body that was the presence of God.
Wow.
And I think, I guess I want to be careful. I'm not saying that we shouldn't strive hard to learn better skill and craft. But honestly, I do think a lot of times we do that in an attempt to make up for a lack of the Spirit's presence.
Yeah.
And we are grasping for something that can only happen by what the older Christians, you know, would have called the unction. That there was something that Eugene so deeply knew of God that was so wedded to who he was that it carried, that authority carried with him as he spoke. By most homiletic classes in most seminaries, I assume he would have gotten mediocre grades. But if you're asking how did the Holy Spirit fill his mind and his words and his voice so that the power and presence of God would be manifest in the living word coming to the people of God, that was potent. But in some ways, it also was for those who had ears to hear.
Right.
There were a number of people that I think even now would say, I didn't get too much out of that. And that's, you know, that's fine. But I think if you were attuned to what was happening, I think if you were attuned to what Eugene was actually doing, it was a deep grace.
Yeah. Well, and I resonate so much with that because, it's the character piece. It's the, what he, that attunement, that fostering, that ability to receive that deep grace and that presence that you're talking about. What did he do? And we talk about this often in the podcast, or the practices. I mean, you mentioned like running or hiking or Sabbath, but I think for a lot of us, we want that depth with the Spirit. We want that love for the presence. And again, not just because Eugene did it, we should just go out and copy. But is there something that you just came across that you were like, man, you could see the intentionality at which he lived? I mean, for me, right from the beginning when of the book, and one of the kids are going down to see their dad to tell him that dinner's ready, if I remember the story right, and opens up the office and they see their dad with the prayer shawl and just in this moment of prayer and just kind of like stepping back to say, seeing what his dad was doing. And it might've been for breakfast if I remember right. But just this, you saw this practical, this intentionality, but is there something that practices that he did that allowed himself deeper, deeper, deeper connection with the presence of God?
I should say first, Eugene was asked this kind of question all the time. And most of the time he didn't answer it.
Yeah.
And the reason why is he was really concerned about people's penchant for replication.
Yep.
And frankly, kind of playing into the, tell me the three things to do and then I'll conquer that and then I'll do it. Right. And so I think what I would say is he was one of the most disciplined people I've ever known, but it was fairly easy for him. It was an expression of his personality. And so there were certainly disciplines, but he actually didn't even like the word discipline that much. He felt like discipline in our current cultural moment plays into our Pelagian sense of self-effort. He kept looking for other words to emphasize its grace. It's being available to grace. So when someone ever asked him, how do I learn how to pray? One of his normal first responses would be, what do you love? And then once you find what you love, how do we make that prayer? So, but if I had to say one thing that maybe could keep us from the risk of just replication, I would say it was unhurried time. So, you know, obviously he encountered the scriptures regularly. He was a man of scripture. He prayed. He memorized vast portions of the Psalter and much of it in Hebrew. And he had a cycle of how he would pray the Psalms through each week. Not all the Psalms, but he would pick like 7 Psalms, one for each day. And he would just have this cycle and he would pray them each week. And he purposely picked certain Psalms to go with certain days because it would represent the frame of the week or what he was doing that day, et cetera. But I really think at the deep heart of it was his, because prayer became not something he did, but something he was. He was a prayer. His life was a prayer, truly. And I think that required seeing the whole of his life as wrapped up in the life of God, as the center story being God, and it pulling all of him into that. I think one of the grave things that we struggle with and was just a great place of disconnect between how we live and Eugene lived is we are still, no matter when we say the opposite, we are still compartmentalizing our life.
Right.
He just wasn't. And he removed himself. He purposely said no to big things. He purposely said no to things that most of us would have a very difficult time saying no to. Because it would stroke our ego. But he wanted something else more. He wanted God.
Wow. It reminds me when he, you know, his mom was Pentecostal, grew up and didn't ever feel like he could speak in tongues. And, you know, he ended up wanting to go meet with someone, his mom suggested. And he went out there and I think the guy was swinging on a hammock or sleeping on a hammock. And he just said, hey, can you teach me how to pray? And the guy's response was, I don't pray. But he was looking for those steps. He was looking for how can I do this? And he said, 6 years later, I understood that if he would have given me the steps, I would have just done the steps. And he gave me a bigger. And so the fact of, you know, later in life when people are like, how do I get what you have? I love just that question. What do you love? And then how do you pray and live towards that? It's so beautiful. When I just can't recommend this book enough. I just thought it was such a gift that you were given and a gift that you gave so many of us who have been blessed by the work that Eugene and Jan and their life really ushered in for grace and for truth. So thank you for that. I'm curious, I know you said this at the beginning about what you're doing at Western. What's your hope with it? I mean, obviously you stepped out pastoral ministry to kind of step into this. Is it up and running right now? Is there programs that are going to be? Can you give us a little bit more of like, hey, and if people wanted to learn more about you and about this program, where they could go?
Sure. So yes, we moved here in August and right, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, obviously. And so we've been slowly putting things together. So the first thing that we're doing is offering 2 Doctor of Ministry cohorts. The first one is called Holy Presence, Eugene Peterson and the Pastoral Imagination. And the applications for that are actually closed now. And the next one is called The Sacred Art of Writing. And so it's you know, my two loves, Eugene's two loves. Those are 3-year cohorts, just diving into this work. We'll be starting other circles of friendship for pastors and artists and creatives. We hope in October of next year to start a gathering called Doxology, which is going to be trying to have conversations along these same themes. And if people want to learn more, they can go to thepetersoncenter.org, and there's some information there on the email list. They can sign up at the bottom. And then my personal writing site is wincollier.com. If you ask what I'm hoping for, the first thing I would say is what we're not hoping for. We're not starting a mausoleum to Eugene. We're not going to spend the next decade only asking, what would Eugene say? But what we are doing is we're recognizing that Eugene was a witness to God, a witness to pastoral fidelity in a time where we are desperate need of faithful pastors, and to a fresh, imaginative, Jesus-awakened way of encountering a living scripture and God's presence in making us truly human in this world. And so at the center, what we're hoping to do is to be, follow Eugene's example and be a witness like he was, to God's presence and God's way in the world. And we're hopeful that God will open doors and allow us to be faithful in that.
That's amazing. Last question, because you mentioned the cohorts, and I know that Eugene did this often where he allowed people to, you know, and groups of pastors to come out to Montana to be with him. Is the cohort connected? Because just that's been that was kind of a spirit of how he opened up and the hospitality of he and Jan. Or was it just more of like, hey, this is the best learning opportunity that we could think of for people all over the world, or a little of the two?
Yeah. Well, it's something I've been involved in for the last 20 years. With another group that I've led called the Genesis Project, where we just bring people together. And honestly, I just don't know. I think for pastors particularly, we just don't need a lot more information.
Yeah.
I think we need friendship and we need God. And I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm simple-minded. I don't know how else to do that other than to get a small group of people sitting around a circle, sharing good food and good beverages and a good fire and good words and some space that allows that space to become friendship and prayer in many respects, because I just can't imagine how else we'd do it.
Wynn, thank you for just the time. And again, just for the book. And I'm so excited for all of the listeners to go to Amazon, go to Barnes & Noble, to pick it up, to read it. And you'll get a sense of just that theology and geography. You'll get a sense of that just sacred longing that Eugene had. But there are so many practicalities that you'll look at your life, look at where God's placed you. But I promise you, by just seeing how he pastored the people that were right in front of you, this book is incredibly timely for right now, because like Wynn said, we need these kinds of pastors. People who aren't chasing the next big thing, but have that ability to say no and love the people that God has put before them, because they understand the grace that God has given to them. Wynn, thank you for joining us on the Craft and Character podcast. It means the world, and many blessings to this new endeavors. And I hope that you enjoy tons of good coffee from Le Mangelo's. So much love, man. Grace and peace.
All right. Thank you. Peace to you.